Coming up on Open Source with Tony Motley, Alberto Marzan is a powerful business executive. He's been involved in multiple diverse ventures in the health, food service, and entertainment sectors, and more. Marzan has now turned his attention to the TV streaming market. I'll talk to Alberto Marzan about his latest venture, Vuma TV, next.
The way that Hollywood works is you have very few decision makers that are green lighting projects. Those decision makers are primarily in one class of executive. Those are the folks that are running the large and major studios that have unlimited spending power to create content.
Alberto Marzan is the founder and CEO of Vuma TV. Vuma means all together in Zulu. Marzan has positioned Vuma TV to bridge the gap in media for global multicultural audiences and consumers of color. Alberto Marzan, welcome to Open Source.
Thank you very much, Tony. I'm happy to be here and excited to share what we've been through.
Well, I'm excited to hear your story, and I'm excited about when I talk to people, I really want to know their journey and what they're doing. But to be launching a streaming service where streaming services are popping up all over the place, what's that like and why?
If I don't get asked that question 5-10 times a week, I'm gonna get struck by lightning. But the first thing that I'm gonna say just before saying anything is that everybody needs to know that Breonna Taylor's killers are still free. And they need to be brought to justice, because that is something that is very, very important for not just the Black and Brown community to be able to see happen, but also because it's just wrong. And that needs to be addressed immediately. But to get to your question, the media in today's age is basically the new oil. Think about in the early 70s, in the 80s, the oil boom that happened in America, media has taken its place. And what I mean by that is that the currency and the importance and the power that media has transcends itself globally throughout all of the borders around the world. And just as important, it impacts the youth and the children of our generation. So, we felt at Vuma that there was a huge gap and a huge divide in how Hollywood currently works, and where the opportunities were for Vuma as a business was to service communities of color, people with physical disabilities, people, in front and behind the lens that currently don't have opportunities to work in a sophisticated media or entertainment environment, because we have been locked out of some of those conversations for a very long time. We feel at Vuma that there's a tremendous responsibility that we have, and also an opportunity that we have. I'm not going to sit here and say it's not an opportunity, but we look at it first and foremost as a responsibility. There are more streaming networks now in North America than there's ever been. And you hear about a new one coming up every other month, it sounds like. However, if you look across the board, the majority of those streaming networks are focused on the mainstream white audience. And the mainstream white audience is what the Netflixes of the world, the Hulus, the Disneys of the world are really catering to. And we look at those 800-pound gorillas and we say, great, we love that they're out there, because it also helps to drive innovation within the industry and allow somebody like Vuma to take shape. But there is a tremendous gap and a need for content that is representative of how we live our lives, of who we are, of what our circle of friends and influences are, that the Netflixes and the traditional streaming networks of the world really don't address properly. So in a nutshell, I mean, that is why Vuma is around today, and we have some very big and ambitious goals for it.
It's interesting, the perspective that you presented. It made me think one thing is that no longer will anyone ask you, I guess, I'm assuming, well, nobody is asking you, is streaming a possibility now? Because everybody knows it's possible now. So I guess that objective has kind of been eliminated. But my real question is, where do you fit in? I mean, we've got BET, which is not, it's a cable service, not a streaming service. But where, I don't want to pigeonhole you, but where does Vuma fit in to this gap in Black programming?
Sure. No, I think it's a great question. So I would say that some of our value drivers or key differentiators at Vuma are, number one, that we're a global OTT streaming platform. So we have similar technical capabilities than the larger networks do. We operate all around the world. Today, somebody in Lagos, Nigeria, in anywhere in the continent, in Central and South America, in North America, can download the Vuma app on 9 different devices, iOS, Android, Roku, Apple TV, so on and so forth, and start to watch content that is relatable, that is important, that is authentic. So number one, we're a global platform, which is really, really important. Most of our competitors are regional platforms. And when I say regional, it means that they don't have the scale or the bandwidth to operate globally. They don't have the licensing or the content agreements to stream that content globally. And we do, because it's really important that we all get connected globally around content that's important. And the other important point that I'll say, Tony, is that, you know, it's not an exclusive platform, which is why we're always talking about diverse content. We're talking about bringing diversity, not just cultural diversity, not just regional diversity, but also, you know, gender diversity. You hear a lot of news coming out of Hollywood, which is really marketing, in my opinion, about how they have tackled and have really started to pay attention to gender roles within content creation, gender roles and equality for folks in front of the camera and behind the lens. When in reality, those numbers haven't changed. Those numbers haven't changed since the early 80s. But now what Hollywood is doing is obviously creating a spin on it to stay on top of the conversation, because they've gotten some heat recently, and rightfully so. So we're looking at diversity in its totality. And that's really the way that people that are connected to us and interested in our content live their lives.
You present what Hollywood's done as a marketing statement. And that's true. Yeah. But the good thing is that Vuma and other people in this space, because you exist and you're doing what you're doing, you provide a check, a real check on them, because you can threaten that business by driving into that space and providing service and opportunity.
100%. I mean, traditionally, Tony, the way that Hollywood works is you have a very few decision makers that are green lighting projects. And when I say projects, I'm speaking about content. Those decision makers are primarily in one class of executive. Those are the folks that are running the large and major studios that have unlimited spending power to create content. The content that they started creating many, many, many years ago was content that was culturally close to them. And as Hollywood and the media and the entertainment engine started to evolve, they realized that there were stories that were more powerful than their own stories. And they started to create content around Black and brown and other cultures and bringing them to light. And strategically, what that did was it really took our stories and allowed somebody else to tell them for us. And we were still not allowed in the room. And that still is the way that Hollywood operates.
I have a question for you there. I want to interrupt you for one second. So we hear so-and-so has a deal. So-and-so has a production deal. So-and-so, you know, these different athletes or stars or celebrities, whatever, have these deals. Are you saying, in essence, those deals are kind of bullshit deals?
Say that again.
Well, you know, we hear often that a certain a star or an athlete or whoever has a production deal with so-and-so, some company or some network. But the content that we see still remains the same mostly. So are we saying when we hear these kind of deals, these production deals that people have, are they just kind of bullshit deals? That's what I'm saying.
Well, I think that they're not bullshit deals because they're very strategically placed or created to meet some type of initiative. Let me give you a perfect example. There is another streaming service that I'm not gonna name any names, but I'm very close with the founder of that network. That network was used by AT&T. Way back when they were trying to purchase Warner Media, to basically get the federal judge to greenlight AT&T's purchase of Warner. And how did that happen? The streaming service went to AT&T. AT&T invested millions of dollars into the streaming service. And the only reason why they invested into that streaming service was because the first time AT&T went in front of the Supreme Court to get the deal greenlit. The judge said, no, there's not enough diversity included into this package. So what did AT&T do? They went in and gave this other company millions of dollars. They checked that box off. The judge saw that AT&T was compliant in his request and then greenlit the deal for AT&T to buy Warner Media. Fast forward not even a year and a half, AT&T now owns a very large stake in that company. They're not allowing them to restructure that debt. They're not allowing any other investor into the company. So they're trying to squeeze the life out of it. So to answer your question, they're not bullshit deals. They're all very carefully created and strategically placed to continue the domination and the exclusion of people of color in decision-making roles.
Okay. That's very excellent information. Now, for Vuma, is this an opportunity net for content creators as well?
100%. I mean, when I said earlier that we have a responsibility to empower not just our North American community, because we see our community as a global community, and the global community is made up of different people that have lived different lives. However, they see the world through the similar lens that you and I do, which is a lens of equality, which is a lens of, hey, let's work hard, let's empower and build our communities up, as opposed to what we are used to today. So, yes, content creators now come to us from all over the world because now we are an outlet for them to create content and have it be seen by an audience, a global audience that wants to see that type of content. And, when Netflix was marketing that they were spending $7-8 billion of content, everybody under the moon thought, hey, we're going to get a deal with Netflix. And obviously that just doesn't happen because they're focused on very specific type of content and audience.
Right. They cherry pick some African Americans, and then the rest is kind of pretty much still just all white.
Correct.
Where can I see Vuma? You said Fire TV, Roku, those things. And what does it cost? What are we asking for people to invest in that?
One of our other key differentiators is that we have a free account. If you don't want to pay for content or for a subscription to Luma, you don't have to. You sign up for the free account and you can watch any of the content, any of the titles that we have. You just have to sit through through commercials. And many people today are completely fine with that just because of the saturation of the marketplace in North America. You go to Europe, we have an office in London. You go to Europe and it's a completely different appetite. You go to the continent and it's a completely different appetite. So we have a free account and then you have a paid account. If you don't want to watch commercials, you pay the $6.99 per month and you can watch all of the Luma content you want. Currently, we are on iOS, Apple TV, Android TV, Amazon Fire Stick, Roku, and next month we'll be on Samsung, LG, Vizio, Xbox, and Sony. So, I mean, we're really looking to grow this as a global brand. Not just because of the environment that we are in or the importance of content in our society today, but because the need for our global addressable market is stronger than it's ever been. And we just want to be able to have control over the type of content that's available.
That's interesting. Now, you mentioned these. We started off this conversation. You mentioned Breonna Taylor, which is a jumping off point for me. What impact has this movement had on your business plan or opportunities that are presented to you, or how has it impacted mm-hmm. you?
You know, the impact, I call it the unfortunate perfect storm, because it's unfortunate that in 2020, in 2019, in 2018, we're still dealing with this bullshit. And it's just, you know, it is challenging to just as a man of color that comes from a Black family and has Black nieces and nephews. I mean, I am, don't get me activated, Sony, because this will turn into a very different type of conversation. But it is, it's just infuriating that we're still dealing with this bullshit. And that's the unfortunate part. The storm is that, you know, we launched during the middle of this unprecedented pandemic. Like, the fuck is a pandemic? And where is it? Like, why is it happening now in 2020? So all of these factors are absolutely crippling to us as humans and as a society. Yet the importance of Luma has skyrocketed. People are at home more than ever before, and there have been a number of conversations that I've been a part of regarding. Our kids being at home more than ever, what are they watching and how does that transfer into their psyche and what does that do to them in this important adolescent age? Knowing that children absorb the most amount of information, humans absorb the most amount of information between the ages of 5 and 13. So if you think about that, between the ages of 5 and 13, our brains are absorbing and taking in more information than they will ever take in our entire lives. And now you cross-reference that against what they're seeing in the media, what they're seeing in content. So there is, you know, we're looking way around the curve here, but there is some real concern that we have at Luma just because the level of content, the type of content that's out there could be more detrimental than empowering. So it's a really hot topic for us internally. So we're focused on combating a lot of that.
That's amazing. I know as a young boy, I was in New York one summer and I saw Shaft. In the theater with Richard Roundtree. And I tell you, mm-hmm. that changed my life. I mean, not in the sense of it changed the path of my life, but it changed how I saw the world, because he represented a black man that was had his own agency that I had never seen before. Sidney Poitier was suave and he was debonair, but he was a regular around the corner brother who wasn't taking nothing from anybody. And so I can tell you, absolutely, what we see impacts how we see the world.
Mm-hmm. Let me share with you from my side of the table. When I was young, my family is Dominican, Haitian, and Venezuelan. It's like the United Nations in my family, trust me. We immigrated to the United States through the traditional immigrant story. We went through the immigration system. And I clearly remember, I was 11 years old when I got to the U.S. I remember the type of content that we were being fed, even in the Dominican Republic. The type of content that we were being fed was, here's how people in America live. They live on golf courses. They wear their, they wear their sweaters. They play tennis. They do all of the drive golf carts around. Here's what it's going to be like when we get to America. And we got to Miami, like most immigrants from that part of the world, you get to Miami first. We got to Miami, and I remember getting to the airport, and I was like, "Oh, we're in the wrong place," because this is not what I was expecting to see. And from your experience and my experience, the science and the data that I just referenced, content and media is pinnacle, and in a child's. And how a child sees himself, and it's a very important stage in a human's life, in a child's life, if he or she cannot or can see themselves on TV. So it's something to really pay attention to.
And you know what? It's funny too. What you said is, again, I think the biggest part of white supremacy is that it's a lie. And that white people believe the lie. I think as much as it impacts you as an immigrant and me, someone that's born here, and it does impact us. But the biggest impact is on white folks because they believe it. I remember being in the second grade, and here I am. That was a long time ago. Let me say that. And a white girl in my class asked me had I been to a certain suburban community in this city, and I said yes, I'd been there. And she very sternly told me, "No, you haven't, because we don't have Negroes there." And it's like, what? But again, these are kind of stereotypes that are reinforced. And where do people get them from? Mostly from media.
Right. I mean, just to give you a peek into my upbringing, my family, and the journey of becoming American, because that is something that every single immigrant wants to become, is part of America. It's like why we came here. It's why our parents killed themselves to bring us here. And it's because this is the land of opportunity, but what they don't tell us is, there is a minefield of mines out there that we have to navigate and hope to not get blown up in order to be successful. So
absolutely,
I'll tell you another story. I mean, when we get to Miami, we get to this place, this little city right outside of Fort Lauderdale, like west of Fort Lauderdale, called Davie, Florida. D-A-V as in Victor, I-E.
I've heard of it, yes.
And Davie is the very first time that me and my family saw mounted KKK. And when I say mounted, I mean like in hoods, in their whole dummy outfit. And that was the first time that we got introduced to American idiotic racism. And we were, you know, we basically, there was a bunch of us. I have five sisters, and I'm the only son. And we obviously got connected to a church because we grew up in a church. And we had a little efficiency in the backyard of somebody that went to church with us. And that was our very first home. And we gradually moved out of that. We moved out of that and moved to the projects, straight into the projects. And I never felt more home in the projects than any other place that I had been in the United States. Why? People looked like us. People didn't give us these crazy ass looks. They realized that we spoke Spanish, and they were like, wow, these people speak Spanish, but they look like us. However, I grew up, I mean, that's really where I grew up. So we go to church every single Sunday. I mean, we went to church like Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Right. Saturday.
Real black folks. Real black folks.
I mean, real stuff. So we went to church twice on Sundays, just to let you know, how deep we were in it. And one day, one Saturday morning, my family obviously gets into our big station wagon, the ones with like the brown wood panels on the side. And you got the two chairs that look out the window. It looks like you're about to take off in like a roller coaster ride because you're like sunk into the basement of the floor.
Right.
And you got two little seats back there. So there were four of us in the back. And then my mom and dad were obviously sitting in the front, and we're taking a regular drive to church. And we noticed that there's an abnormal amount of traffic getting to this stop sign and this intersection. And we get to the intersection and we see that there are just cops everywhere. And, you know, my parents and our family, we just weren't used to this. And we get closer and closer to the intersection. And on one side of the street, there are just a bunch of KKK people on their horses, you know, picketing and doing whatever they're doing. On the other side are black and brown folks. And we're driving through this entire situation. And it has been something that has been ingrained in, I would say, all of our minds, because that was the very first time that we were introduced to the lie that you just mentioned. And you KKK had an office, and they may still have an office in Dayton, Florida today.
Wow. As an immigrant, as we go, we're 28 minutes into this or so. I just wonder, as an immigrant, when you see what's happened to immigration policy in the last handful of years, how does that make you feel?
Scared, probably just scared for, if something drastic doesn't happen, if we don't take control back, it is going to be a scary country. And we need to take control back. We need to be able to get this idiot out of the White House and all of his members, because it's a race war. I mean, it is what it is. It is a race war. I don't care what side of the fence you sit on. It is a race war that is currently going on, and somebody's going to come out as the winner. Hopefully, it's us.
So when you say smart racism and you want people to wake up to smart racism, what do you mean?
So I'll give you an example. So I'm currently in Minneapolis. So before I moved to Minneapolis in January of this year, I was in between LA and London before that. So Minneapolis, I think, is the smartest, if not one of the smartest racist states in the union. And here's why. Minneapolis has a very strong corporate infrastructure. I think they're they're in the top 10 of power because they have the most amount of Fortune 500 and Fortune 1000 companies per capita out of any state. They're in the top 10 of that. So they have a very, very strong economy. And what is the norm in the state is saying things like, we don't really care what color you are. Everybody's welcome here.
We don't see color.
There's a large Norwegian contingency in the state. I mean, if you look back at the state, I mean, it's the Vikings and Swedes and Norwegians really make up a lot of the state. And, so they lean on the fact that they don't see color because of their cultural ancestry. So they say things like, hey, this is Minnesota nice, we do things differently here. And they start to pepper the society here with those types of term that alienate others that are not from here. So you can ask any person of color in the States, they have never felt Minnesota nice. They have never felt like this was for or built for them or that they have some type of ownership in. And obviously I'm generalizing here, but I feel very positive and confident that this is fact. So you have all of these societal norms and terms that Minnesotans just use, when in reality, it is just a nice way of strategically keeping certain people out of the conversation. And it starts from a very, very young age in the state. The state has the largest Somali population in the country. However, they also have the lowest high school graduation of people of color in the country. And why is that? And it's because of how the political climate highlights where some of these people of color can live and they can't live, what schools they can go to, what schools they can't go to. So it starts at a very adolescent age, and by the time you know it, they're graduating 8 white kids to 2 kids of color. And that is what gets into the corporate infrastructure, the corporate workforce in the state. So it is done very, very strategically. It is done in a way that there's a whole smokescreen, and unless you're really looking and paying attention, you think that Minnesota is not racist. When it's produced some of the most publicized killings of people of color in the last 5 years.
So when you say smart, you mean that it's as sinister, basically.
Extremely sinister, and you're absolutely right. And they pride themselves on being very smart here, and it's a very smart state. But unless your name is ends in Carlson, Peterson, Swanson, you're going to be looking at it from the outside of the bubble.
Man, Alberto, this has been an amazing conversation, and I tell you, I had no idea what I was going to hear, but I tell you, that's the thing that makes this exciting. You said, what's the big payoff for me was being able to talk to you and hear your perspective. Really, that was outstanding. I appreciate it so much.
No, thank Wish you, we Tony. Had,
we could do another half hour. I mean, honestly, that was fantastic. But honestly, I think I want people to go to, is it vuma.tv? How do they find you?
It's vumatv.com.
Vuma TV is
where you get the website, but you can go to any of your major app stores and download the Vuma app today and start the content journey through Vuma.
That's great. I hope everybody will check it out. I think I'm going to download it now when we get off of this platform. I'm going to do it. I'm going to join. I'm going to sign up. I'm going to go for a paid account. We'll put some money in your pocket.
Yeah. No,
and
I'll
encourage
it.
Other people to do the same thing. Yeah.
There's some amazing content from Nigeria that we have. There's amazing content from France. from the UK, from North America, because what we're trying to show is that, you know, the world is a lot more diverse than these fools at the White House make it out to be.
And last thing, I guess, too, for a content producer, because a lot of my friends are, how do we get involved?
So you can go to our corporate site, and we encourage you to go to the corporate site and submit any type of content that you want, whether it's a script, whether it's a finished project, or it's an incomplete project. We'll look at all of it. Go to corp.boomatv.com, and you can get to the content submission area and send us your projects.
Great. I appreciate it. My guest has been Alberto Marzan, founder and CEO of Vooma TV. You've been listening to Open Source with Tony Motley. Like it, share it, rate it, tell a friend. Thanks for listening. Open Source with Tony Motley is a production of Duet Digital Media and McLaughlin Media.